Now, collective life or collective existence has various aspects. And we may say that there are three principal aspects. There's the strictly social aspect, there's also the political aspect, and there is the economic aspect. And Buddhism has teachings which cover all these three aspects. For instance, if we look at the social side, we find that Buddhism has various social teachings, especially in the context of ancient Indian life. We find that the Buddha was not at all in favor of the dominant feature of social life in India at his time. That is to say, the caste system, the system of hereditary caste, which is still very much a feature of the social scene in India today. According to that system, your position in society, your rank in society, was dependent upon your birth. If you were the son of a Brahmin, well, you were a Brahmin. If you were the son of a trader, you were a trader, and you couldn't get away from that. And even now, in India, this system is very, very strong and all-pervasive, we may say, especially in the villages, where it has a very stultifying effect upon human initiative generally. So the Buddha, in contradistinction to this teaching or tradition of hereditary caste, said very clearly and very emphatically that the criterion of a man's position and place in society should be not birth, but instead worth. And this he very strongly emphasized. So this is just an example of Buddhism's teaching on the social side. In the same way, we find that politically speaking, Buddhism upholds, or rather upheld in ancient times, the ideal of what it calls the Dharma Raja. There are a number of sutras devoted to this topic. Dharma, of course, means truth, righteousness, reality. Raja means the king or even the government. So the ideal of Dharma Raja really represents the ideal of the government of righteousness. The ideal that even in political life, political affairs, ethical and spiritual considerations and values must be supreme, must be paramount. The idea that politics shouldn't be just a cockpit, as it were, of jockeying interests, rival factions, not just a question of manipulation and string pulling, but that one should try to see what ethical, what spiritual principles are involved and apply them even in one's political life and political affairs. And of course, this political ideal or this political teaching of Buddhism received in India its greatest exemplification in the case of the great emperor Ashoka. Ashoka was a great ruler, as some of you know, of the Maurya dynasty. He lived about 200 years after the Buddha, and he had inherited from his father the kingdom of Magadha, which he proceeded to expand, and he promptly swallowed up nearly all the other states in India. He had a series of sort of mopping up operations, and the state of Magadha increased to dimensions which exceeded even those of present-day India and Pakistan. But the last state which was left for Ashoka to subdue in the days before he became a Buddhist was the state of Kalinga, on the east coast, roughly corresponding to the modern state of Bihar. So we are told, and Ashoka has recorded these facts in his own rock edicts, which still survive, hundreds of thousands of people were slaughtered, and hundreds of thousands of people were made homeless in this war. And Ashoka saw all this. He saw and he realized the misery of war, the misery which was brought about by his own conquest. And he says himself, in his own words, his own language, in his rock edicts, which we can read even today, he said that remorse and sorrow overcame him when he saw the misery which war had inflicted, when he saw all the dead, and when he saw the homeless and the widows and the orphans, and great remorse and sorrow overcame him. So he gave up this career of conquest. And possibly it's the only example in history of a great conqueror who stopped, as it were, in mid-career, because he realized the moral wickedness of it all. He just stopped. And he completely reversed. Before this sort of conversion, he was known as Chanda Ashoka, which means the fierce or the wicked Ashoka. But afterwards, he was known as Dhamma Ashoka, which means the good or the righteous Ashoka. And from that day onwards, he seems to have considered himself the father of his people. Of course, he didn't give up his own political power, but he very definitely regarded himself as the servant of the people. And he quite explicitly proclaimed as his ideal the service of those whom he was supposed to be governing. And he upheld their welfare and their good as the major objective of his administration, his government and his policy. So Ashoka is a very conspicuous example, perhaps the only real example in Indian history of someone who tries to apply Buddhist teachings directly to political life. We know, of course, that Ashoka gave great support to Buddhism. He dispatched missionaries in all directions, and not only to different parts of the East, not only to India, but even to Alexandria, even to Palestine, and even to Greece. So this is just an example. Unfortunately, Buddhist rulers, or nominally Buddhist rulers, haven't always followed the example of the Emperor Ashoka. But Ashoka does very much deserve credit for having tried to apply very practically the political teachings of the Buddha, or rather to apply the teachings of the Buddha on the political plane or the political level. Incidentally, some of you may know, as some of you may have read, H.G. Wells' very moving tribute to Ashoka in his Short History of the World. And he says there that amongst all the hundreds and the thousands of names of royal highnesses and serene highnesses which adorn the pages of history, he says the name of Ashoka shines, and shines alone, a star. So this is the judgment, this is the tribute of H.G. Wells to Ashoka. Because Ashoka tried to apply in the political life of India, in his own day-to-day administration and government, the great moral and spiritual principles of the Buddha's teachings.